This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk Show 18. I can't believe we've done 18 already. It seems like we started just a couple of weeks ago. Today we are going to do things backwards. If you're a regular listener, you know we usually have news and reviews on first, but we're going to do it the other way around. You'll work out why a bit later in the show. Joining me in the studio are our special guests of today. They are two young writers whose new show, Wasted, starts on the 26th of July on E4. They are BAFTA-winning writers. They're geniuses. They've said to me that they don't mind me bigging them up as much as possible. They are probably the greatest writers that have ever lived. Their previous work, they've worked on shows like Cuckoo, Paddington the film, World of Gumball. They are, of course, James Lamont and John Foster. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Can you clarify who's who for the people at home?
I'm John, John Foster.
And I'm James, and you can always tell us apart because I'm the one that looks like a fat Wolverine.
I'm a bit taller.
That doesn't work quite on radio, audio only,
imagine I sound like a fat Wolverine.
Yeah, okay. So if you can imagine a fat Wolverine, that's your words, that's not
my
mine.
Words, my words, yeah.
You've also got a little bit of a Kevin Smith about you as well.
I have had that before. Yeah, the Kevin Smith, especially when I wear sportswear.
And also, really, yeah. Like weird ice hockey outfits.
If I were you, I'd leave with Kevin Smith over
Wolverine. You think so?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
I think he's disappointed less people.
Also, I think people would, when they see you after they've said, oh, imagine Kevin Smith, they go, oh, no, yeah. You're actually much better looking than that. Whereas with Wolverine, they're always going to go,
it's always a downgrade. You're always playing second fiddle.
Thanks for joining us, guys. We're going to start the show, actually, because we always get our guests to pick some either score or music from films and sometimes TV shows. You guys have picked a couple of beauties, actually. And this first one brings back a lot of memories from my childhood because it seems to have appeared in every film from the 80s. Maybe you guys have a specific film that you remember it from. What's the song? Tell us the song.
It's called... Ooh Yeah by Yellow, but it's also known as
every 80s film.
Yeah.
How's it go? Like, ooh yeah yeah, De Bow Bow.
I don't know if anyone calls it that.
De Bow Bow.
Actually, interestingly, we also use it in our show.
We loved it so much we put it into one of our episodes. Yeah,
but there's probably an entire audience that don't know that song.
They will know it. They definitely will know it. They just might not know that they know it.
Yeah,
it's like Ferris Bueller. Yeah, Secret of My Success. Basically anything in the 80s where like
a young
it got
sort
a bit
of
sexy.
Slightly precocious upstart is doing something a bit sexy.
Suddenly he looks at a woman and there's like a fan on and then this song starts.
I love this. I remember it. This is a very controversial thing to say because I know people adore this film, but I never liked Ferris Bueller.
I had not as good as it should be.
Well, it's not the film itself. It's just, I watched it recently because someone was saying to me, I think you're insane for not liking that film. It's so good.
Yeah.
And I love all John Hughes's other films. It is John Hughes, isn't it? I am getting that right.
No, I'm sure
it's
so,
John Hughes. And I rewatched it recently, and the same feelings came back, which was he was the sort of kid I fucking hated at school. Not only is he massively privileged living in a huge house, but he's getting away with doing whatever he wants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really, and that's, I think I subconsciously felt that as a kid. I was like, I don't like this. Anyway.
Well, he's dead now, so.
Oh. No, he's not. What, the character? Or
both,
are you breaking
both,
news
both
about
the
Matthew
and the actor?
Really?
Yeah,
yeah. Matthew wow, you've heard it here first.
His spirit died while making that film.
I do.
He's a dick, though. Ferris Bueller's a dick.
Oh, yeah. Bueller is.
I don't know about him.
I feel like you keep trying to slander Matthew Broderick or say
Matthew
he's
Broderick.
Dead. But I remember it more from Secret of My Success.
Yeah,
because
it's
so big in that. The limousine scene.
Limousine scenes that you don't get enough of anymore these days. Yeah. And like close-ups of like older women putting on lipstick.
It's
because it's hard to film in a limousine.
Okay, well this is Oh Yeah by Yellow.
Oh yeah.
Wow, one of the most beautiful love songs ever written.
One of the most repetitive love songs.
Yeah, right? So you just mentioned, so you've got this show Wasted coming out on E4 on the 26th of July, and you mentioned that you use this. I want to bring that up in a second, but first of all, can you just describe what your show is? Because I don't quite know how to.
I think that's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, is one of in terms of a one-liner, how do you describe
it? It's about four friends who've known each other since school, who've never left their home village. Mm-hmm. And also one of them is having strange visions of Sean Bean.
Yeah, who's kind of like the character's spirit guide that comes to him, meets him in the woods in his dreams.
And it's set in the West Country in a sort of nondescript village, but we've always imagined that it's very near Stonehenge. So okay. The show sort of has a surreal, mythical vibe to it.
Yeah, and one of the things that we tried to do with the show and with our director, Tom Marshall, who's great, was sort of go for like visual, cinematic-y sort of, I wouldn't go so far as to say surreal, but like heightened sort of visual set pieces. So it sort of lifts it out of your sort of traditional sort of people sat around in a pub kind of a sitcom.
And the title Wasted refers to the fact that
it has two meanings.
it's about you know, a time in your life when, you know, you're sort of not particularly ambitious and time flies by and you're kind of making fun of, well, you're bored, but you're making fun of the boredom.
Yeah.
But also it's about
characters getting fucking wasted.
Yeah, which was the thing that really stunned me about how, because I watched the first episode, which has some very funny stuff in it, by the way, and I was surprised that you managed to get a show commissioned that seems to evolve around purely people finding drugs and getting fucked off their heads. Times have changed on television, but that's allowed to be at the forefront rather than hidden.
We did ditch subtlety with this.
And actually, I mean, I suppose the first episode, that features quite strongly, but actually, as the series goes on, you'll hopefully realise that it's not just about that.
Yeah, it's not only about that, but there are...
But it does feature.
Well, that was going to be my question, because that's obviously quite prominent in the first episode, and it's called Wasted. So I was like, wow, they've gone into Channel 4 and said, we want to make a show about drugs.
Weirdly, the show's been in development for a long time.
Right.
And the only thing that's been consistent from the beginning was the characters. Do you know what I mean? We came up with this like group of characters that we liked and their sort of adventures. And yeah, it wasn't until we'd sort of almost finished writing that we looked back at the episodes and we were like, God, they go out and get mashed up like almost every week. So we were like,
see, I thought that was, from watching just one episode, I genuinely thought that was the hook, that was the show, like, hey guys, what about a show about drugs?
It wasn't our intention, I think our intention was to, well, we sort of spent a lot of time trying to work out what it is we were going to write, and we planned all the episodes without really knowing entirely what the show was going to be. But like James said, we knew where it was set, we knew what the characters were, and we had certain storylines we liked. And the more we sort of drew upon things, we sort of realised it was sort of a bit of a love song to that time in your life when, you know, you can be quite frivolous with your health and your body. And
absolutely.
You know,
and I think what we wanted to do as well was like write something about that time of life and that sort of is loosely based on experiences that we either had individually or friends of ours had or
stories we'd heard via other people.
And so we wanted to base it on all that sort of stuff. And then it was like, once we'd done that, we realised that all that sort of stuff involved getting high. So then it was like, all right, that's what the show is.
But I know. It's the sort of show that I wish had been around when I was, you know, that age.
Oh, that's good
because if I had discovered that, I would have been like, guys, look, there's us on screen.
That's really nice to hear.
That's good to hear.
I've showed it to some of my friends that I was young with.
Yeah,
and they've all said at the end, like, God, I want to go back.
That's nice.
I want to have a job where...
Scene where he's trying to hold the pub quiz, that didn't make me want to go back to...
But it's that thing about, like, they all work in a bong shop and, like, you don't care about your job at that time. Everything in your life is there to serve having fun with your friends and your job is meaningless and all of that, and it's just a lovely time of life, and I think there's something quite
romantic and
nostalgic about it.
With the pub quiz as well, it was just sort of the idea of when that's the biggest night of the week, the pub quiz, you know, if you put that into the, you know, the world of our show and see what happens, it's like, how big can you make a pub quiz from, you know, what is perceived as quite a boring pastime in a village.
Yeah.
You know, let's try and make that into something massive and stupid and funny.
Yeah.
And that's where the
well, you certainly did
where the things in episode one.
Is that, do you think that was part of the appeal
for like the channel or broadcast is that it was not a London show. It wasn't. Like, I haven't seen a sitcom in the West Country for a, well, I can't remember when was the last
Vicar
one?
Of Dibley, maybe.
Vicar of Dibley.
Yeah, it's quite different to that.
Yeah. But actually, Vicar of Dibley was more Devon. We're sort of we're in our heads. We're more Wiltshire, Somerset.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
But we're not specific. We're not specific.
I've always loved that part of the world and generally the West Country. There's the weird. There is that thing of they're sort of connected to, like, you know, there's not just Stonehenge, but there are like sacred stones in lots of parts of that world.
Absolutely.
And there is a slightly hippie, even now there's still that hippie.
I've got a theory. Like, well, actually a friend of mine gave me this theory, but I think it's entirely true, that anyone, if you speak to anybody from Bristol down, you know, if you say to them, do you believe in magic? After a couple of pints, they will say, yeah, I believe in magic. Even if they say no to begin with.
You know?
And actually that sort of did lead us down.
The further south you go, the less pints it takes for them to admit.
Is that, does that mean that someone, as a joke, knowing this theory of yours, planted lots of stones randomly in fields and went, look,
about these were 15,000 years ago.
That's the best explanation for the stones I've ever heard.
Yeah, I reckon. The strange sort of juxtaposition of that, though, is that weirdly, I've noticed that a lot of that side of the part of the country vote Conservative as well.
So it's like not my hometown.
No, yeah. What's your hometown?
Cheltenham. They vote Lib Dem every time, and they voted to Remain, which I was
quite surprised
pleased about.
One of the few islands of Remain.
But it's a weird, like, I've done gigs in Bath quite a lot, which I love Bath, and it's always this, I can't quite put my finger on, are you the the slightly more hippie new agey people, or are you quite middle class conservative? It's like
they're like hippies with homes to protect. Like when they were younger, they were hippies in music festivals, and then they like took all their money and bought a beautiful cottage, and they're like, I'm keeping these mortgage prices down.
Certainly places like Cornwall as well have quite strong, you know, almost nationalist identities, because they protect their own language. And they
did they not at one point, was there talk of them becoming their own
and I think that does tie in with an idea to separate, well, we're merging loads of politics together here, but the idea of separation from the EU
and vote
Conservative, you know. And also, I mean, I suppose older people vote Conservative, and there's a lot of older retired people in that part of the world.
That's
pure speculation, but there we go.
We like generalisations on this show. We want to offend as many people. I think, God, if just to stay on the politics thing, at one point, can you imagine that in like 20 years' time, maybe we'll have 17 countries in the UK, which will be like Cornwall, Scotland.
Let's get London.
Cheltenham will be its own country. London will be, I don't know. I don't know how we do
Essex,
it.
Where I'm from, basically already is its own country.
Is it?
Yeah.
Suppose in a way, they were hardcore leavers, weren't they?
Oh, God, yeah. I think my borough was like 23% Remain.
Well, they've left already, haven't they? Essex.
They're madness,
I don't know. I don't know what that meant, but it felt like a barbed comment.
I don't know. I was just being stupid.
So you're from Essex and you're from Cheltenham, Gloucestershire.
Yeah.
How did you guys meet?
We met in London working for a TV company run by Johnny Vaughan called World's End TV. And we were employed together to write internet videos, instructional internet videos for a website called VideoJug.
That still exists.
Which still exists.
Instructional, how-to
videos.
Put together a juicer or something.
And how to change a tire.
How do you write those?
Well,
very laboriously.
Copy the instructions onto a script.
Without wanting to offend anybody there, the way that they presented it to us was, we think the instructions should be very clear, very concise, and me and James always thought, that's kind of boring. So one day they said to me, and James, why don't you go off and make some films together, because you think you two might work quite well together. And then we went off to my flat in Streatham and got a bit stoned, and then filmed a bunch of videos ourselves, basically that were short comedy films, and then handed those in, got told off, got split up.
Yeah, they separated us. Like,
got put on different sides of the office, and then they got put on the website, and they got the most hits on the website. So
Told us off and said, you can't work together. Because
really?
These are
they're winning awards. They've made us millions of pounds, but you can't work together ever again.
Because it's off-brand.
So we thought, you know what, let's start writing together at the weekend.
Let's do our own instruction video.
Exactly.
We're going to do How to Have a Revolution.
So episode 5 of Wasted is a half an hour instructional video.
That's brilliant.
It's not
brilliant.
It's not.
I look forward to that.
But we realised we had done Edinburgh in the past.
I'd actually seen John's show, well, or some of it anyway, in Edinburgh like 5 years before, and we'd both been up at the same time doing shows and stuff, but separately.
Are you both performers as well?
Definitely were.
I mean, not so much these days, but there is that. Well, actually,
we sort of perform to each other in the writers' room.
Yeah, it's kind of the basis
comedy,
for it, really.
Not erotic dances.
Little treats when you come up with a good line.
Yeah.
Here, what about this?
But yeah, we both did.
Because I recognise, we've said this when we walked in, we all feel like we've met maybe or seen each other about, like, but definitely before, from the Edinburgh world. What kind of stuff did you do when you did perform?
I did a bit of stand-up and also did like sketch shows, character shows, stuff like that. And
I used to do sketch shows. I was in a group called HBAM. You probably don't remember them. 2003, 2004. And...
I love the name.
It was a group of comedians from Dublin.
It's
really embarrassing.
What is it?
It was short for How Babies Are Made.
Is it?
Yeah.
I always thought it was like H-Bam, like an H-bomb.
Yeah, or
that's better.
Yeah, like ha-ha explosion.
I mean, anyone that was in that group who's listening, which I'm sure they've got... I don't know if they will be, but they will be equally embarrassed by the name.
I thought it might
be
the name of a town you're from, but you've, like, shortened it, so it become, you know...
We were from Dublin, Trinity in Dublin, and there was quite a few people.
You're from Cheltenham and Dublin.
Well,
and
I went to university in Dublin.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Sorry.
I was going to say, you don't sound very Irish. So you got together and you started writing, and then at what point did you start doing TV stuff?
Well, the first thing we did when we left Videojug was started writing sketches. And we got some sketches submitted to Armstrong and Miller.
Oh, great.
And that was great fun. We really enjoyed that, and the team was great. And then we started writing spec scripts of our own stuff, including Wasted was one of the first things that we wrote as a spec script.
Now, I've got a feeling I've spoken to... was one of your producers in the early days, Seb.
Seb Bowell?
Yeah.
Okay. Seb, yeah.
Yeah, he told me that you had developed it quite a long time ago,
right? Yeah.
And then it just sort of magically came back to life again.
Well, it never really
maybe not
stopped.
Magically.
It never really stopped, came out of development. Like, we had an early pilot, we did another taster tape, we kept working at it, we wrote several different versions of the script.
Well, Channel 4 were always really supportive throughout. I think it was just sort of working out the best time and way to do it.
Yeah, and the best version of the script and the best cast and the best directors and all these kind of things coming together over time. But
in how many years do you think it was in development for? Just because if any people are listening who are developing stuff and they're really disheartened by the fact that it's taken...
I'd say about 4 years.
Yeah, pages to screen about 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean...
And in that time we had a pilot and a taster tape and probably about 3 or 4 scripts.
I mean, we were lucky because we were busy. And a few breakdowns. We were busy on other things during that 4 years, which...
It wasn't just that for four years.
Yeah, we didn't just sit waiting on the phone. But we were lucky on that front. It meant we could sort of... When it kept coming back to life, we could focus on it. And then when it went quiet, we could kind of...
Get on with other stuff.
Not cry.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is remarkable how long... I still don't quite get why it takes people so long to get back to you on things in this...
It's crazy the way things move. Yeah. But then other things happen really quickly, like the Harry Hill film we worked on, like that was commissioned and made within about
a year.
Yeah.
Less than a year.
My God.
Yeah. The whole thing, like, from nothing.
And was that something you were involved in from the very beginning?
Pretty much. I mean,
Harry had written a story outline some time before, but he came to us and we sort of worked with him on that.
Yeah.
Wrote the script with Harry.
Was that fun?
It was great.
It was loads of fun. He's great.
I've heard he's a really nice guy.
He's so nice. And also, like, one of my, like, comedy heroes growing up.
Yeah.
So it was one of those moments where you're like... When you're pitching jokes to someone that you, like, watched when you were growing up, like, it's kind of fun.
The read-through was amazing down in Longcross.
Yeah.
The first day, because we turned up and there was Julie Walters and Matt Lucas.
And Simon Bird.
And we were just like, oh, okay.
Jim Broadbent.
This is happening.
Yeah.
It starts tomorrow.
What's that? I mean, I've written stuff and heard other people... say the lines, but I've either been in it as well or somehow involved more in the production. So you sort of... I don't know if it's different to having been writing something in a room, and then one day suddenly there's these actors.
Yeah, that's
is
great.
It nerve wracking?
Did anyone
ever say a line? You're like, that's not how you fucking say it, Julie Walters.
You
go up at the end.
Was terrible for it. No, she was brilliant. I suppose one thing you often do is, like, you read in the bit parts.
Yeah.
So me and James will assign all the kind of side roles,
right,
so that if there are, like, little one line dudes that come in, you know, we sort of just make sure we keep the energy up by going, that's how that joke should be said.
And everyone's like, why are those two guys shouting everything?
Yeah. These guys are a bit eggy.
I love read through day because it's like the perfect point between, like,
You're like, the only person on the planet who loves read-through day, by
really
the way.
I really like it because it's like, it's the midway point where like, all the cast are there, so it feels much more real than mm-hmm. when you're in the writer's room. Mm-hmm. But it's not finished yet, so you can't hate the product. You can still imagine that it will be like perfect when it's finished. So you get this like beautiful little island in the middle of production where like you can see it all in front of you. But it's still not locked down and unchangeable. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
And also it gives you a good opportunity after that session, once you've heard everybody's real voices, to change the scripts.
Totally.
And you can get stuck in after that.
Coming from a writer's point of view, you maybe have a slightly different approach, but almost every actor, I think, will tell you it's the most nerve-wracking. Because also you hear horror stories that you do a read-through and the next day you get a call saying, sorry, we're going to go, work.
Yeah, and also we've had it the other way where you know, commissioners or channel execs or whatever will listen to a read through and if and not imagine how it might end up. Take it on its face value.
Well, that's the worst thing about it, isn't it? It's like,
that didn't work. You're like, it definitely will when you see
that wasn't the finished version.
Once it's in a castle,
he's going to be stood on a waterfall shouting that at a dragon. So you know, do you know what I mean? Whatever.
But. Yeah, he's got to have makeup on. So Wasted out in what's that? A couple of weeks?
I think about two weeks.
So 26th of July on E4 after Tattoo Fixers.
Yeah, straight after Tattoo Fixers.
I don't know the exact time. Is it 10 p.m.?
I think it's 10 p.m.
Yeah. There's a bit of a link there, right, with the tattoo.
There is a tattoo in our show. Yeah.
And we got a double bill on the first night.
Oh, just quickly, how did you get Sean Bean?
Oh, right,
This has to be quick because we're running out.
Yeah, sure.
We sent him a letter via his agent, an email, just a plea for him to read the scripts. We said, look, it's quite a weird role, but you're the only person in the world who can do it. If you're not the spirit guide for Morpheus, no one else will be.
Yeah.
And, you know, do you want to do it or not? And we'd love you to, basically.
And how many people had you written that?
He was in the script for 4 years.
And how long did he... take to get back to you?
I can't remember, a month or so.
Yeah, about a month.
He's brilliant in it, by the way.
He's really so funny.
He is funny. A great, great man.
Yeah,
and love him. We love him.
And really love him. When I was watching, I was like, good for you, Sean Bean, for doing it.
He's really funny as well. Yeah. Like, really, really funny. And he was a joy to work with. And
great.
We're very grateful.
We always get our guests to pick a guilty pleasure film. And you've picked something that is maybe... I don't know where it fits in the guilty pleasure spectrum. Like, often I have to sort of clarify, do some people feel like it's a terrible film that they know is shit but they love, and other people pick films that they think are underrated or misunderstood.
Yeah.
You've picked Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah.
The Costner Hood.
Damn straight.
The Costner Hood? I'm not sure what that...
He's from the Costner Hood.
Can I just say that wasn't my choice, that was James. I actually think this film's really good.
Okay, so that's my question. First question is, where do you think it sits in the guilty pleasure spectrum?
Okay, like, the thing is, right, is like, it's got Kevin Costner in it, so it can't be really good. It has to be a guilty pleasure. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have this joke with my wife, but the thing is about Kevin Costner is that all his films are amazing, but they're all terrible.
Right.
And
I might have to disagree with you there, but in fact, I'm going to... The reason that we got you on first is because this is going to segue into a chat with James where we'll discuss Costner's CV in length. But
And I will be listening avidly.
Okay, but I like this theory.
I have a joke with my wife that on our deathbed, if we have children around us and we're on our deathbed, and just as we're dying, I pass them a key and I say, there's a box in my wardrobe. No one must know what's in it. Dispose of it now. And they'll take the key and they'll run and they'll think what it is, and it'll just be all my Costner DVDs.
which is how many?
Which is far too many. Yeah. Postman. I've got Postman.
Postman.
Yeah.
Pre-woman, Postman.
It's the Postman.
Do you... what do you feel about Prince of Thieves? Like, a lot of people criticise him for his accent, but actually as a sort of swashbuckling action film, it's... really good entertainment.
Rickman's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, Rickman's a star. I mean, there's the great catapulting moment, for example, which we all remember.
Kevin Costner just shouldn't be wrong. That isn't something I would have pointed out.
Do you know, I can't remember another catapulting moment where human beings catapult over a wall. Has that ever happened
in tandem
film?
As well?
Yeah. In tandem, and enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, they're both Morgan Freeman and Kevin Costner are ecstatic that they're doing that. And also, did they do that for real? Because that was before...
It was real
CGI. There was no CGI in that film.
Yeah. Well, it might have been a stunt man.
Yeah, and did they hit the wall of the castle a few times?
We don't know. We just don't know.
That is historically accurate as well. People did used to catapult themselves.
There was.
Robin Hood did that.
I remember when the film. I remember when the film came out that there was a bit of. I don't know, some weird, not backlash, but like question over the whole Morgan Freeman's involvement.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you know what? He's terrible in it. He's absolutely terrible. I don't think he knows who he's playing because he has a Chinese accent all the way through the movie.
Is it Chinese?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it's Chinese.
Imitate it now, but it's definitely Chinese.
Please don't imitate it.
No, but that's historically accurate as well. That's how, because you know how like accents change over time?
Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah.
Back then, well, I suppose it would be a Moorish accent.
It's
Moorish. Apparently sound slightly Chinese.
Should we do jokes about how Moorish it is?
well, they didn't make a sequel, so not that Moorish.
So do you think it's an underrated film, or do you think it's shit but you love it?
I think that it's shit but I love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's on my 5-minute list. I have a list of films where...
There's no film you can watch in that time.
If it's on for 5 minutes and I haven't turned it off, I have to watch the whole film.
Okay.
So like Die Hard's on the 5-minute list.
Is that true for The Woodsman?
Yeah.
Woodsman's on my 1-minute list.
Oh, yeah.
It's on your... Yeah. That's a pretty dark way to go with your... Do you just get off on the Woodsman?
Yeah. I only need 1 minute.
Yeah. Right, so let's play your second song. Before you leave, guys, thanks for joining us. You've been lovely guests.
It's been a pleasure.
Good luck with your show.
Thank you very much.
This song, actually, I thought when it started, it sounds almost identical to Jump by Van Halen, like the first note So I was like, oh, I recognise this. No, I don't. What the fuck is this? Can you explain what this...
This song comes from the original 1986 Transformers animation movie, and it scores the sequence in which Optimus Prime attacks the Decepticon base.
Nerd.
And honestly, that's all you need to know.
Also, this is in our show, too.
It's actually
the opening track from our show. So thank you, Transformers, for that.
Yeah, well, and we'll have to check out the Labyrinth song you were talking about on another show, because that sounds great. This is The Touch by Stan Bush. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
You got the touch. You got the power. You got the power.
I mean, that does just sound like jump, jump, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. James Gill, everyone. Woo! He's back in the room. James, let's just talk about Costner, because when I found out these guys had picked Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves,
yes.
I was sort of delighted, but I wasn't sure which way they were going to go, and obviously you heard that interview, though. James Lamont, he was saying that he felt like he was doing what everyone did with Costner back in the day, which was like, he's not very good, or he's a bit naff, or he's not very cool, or whatever. And yet, I always liked him. I always thought, well, he makes really good films. Yeah, he's not like a fucking Robert De Niro actor. He's not Tom Cruise, or, you know, depending on like which kind of movie star you're going with, he's a little bit more down the middle. But if you look at his films, he's made some amazing films.
I'm about to unleash a pro-Costner rant.
Okay.
Kevin Costner, for a while, was the biggest movie star on the planet. Now, if you're old like Dan and I are, you will remember how huge Dances with Wolves was. That was a phenomenon for a while. Mm-hmm. It swept the board at the Oscars. It catapulted Costner from a well-liked outsider into the very top of the A-list. And for a while, the guy could do no wrong. Admittedly, like Icarus, perhaps he flew a little bit too close to the sun and was pumping out movies that perhaps Kevin Costner loved and the rest of us, it was trickier to get on board with.
Yeah, yeah.
But for a while, he was the man. And one of my favourite films of all time is The Untouchables. And I think his performance in that film, the chemistry he has with Sean Connery, I know some people don't like that film, don't like his performance. I think that film is
don't like
just,
whose performance?
Don't like Costner's performance. They found Costner wooden.
Yeah.
Strongly disagree. Please revisit The Untouchables. It is just a spine-tinglingly wonderful, there's an extra ingly in there, wonderful movie. So it's a great film. It's the David Mamet
penned
script. It's De Palma, and also, like a lot of classic movies, it's comprised of not just one, but a number of classic scenes, the sort of scenes you can hang your hat on. The scene with the pram, I know it's a nod to Battleship Potemkin, but the scene with the pram where Costner goes, got him, and Garcia goes, got him, and Costner goes, take him. I mean, I'm getting
so
goosebumps.
So
oh, stop it.
And of course, the first time we properly are introduced to Andy Garcia, who in that film is absolutely amazing.
Probably the best thing Andy Garcia has ever done.
But you know what? I get the wooden thing. I get the... because he's so all-American, and in a way that isn't...
There's nothing wrong with that, though, is there?
No, and also, I dispute that he's a terrible actor. Or not terrible, but, like, whatever. Because, actually,
I think he's really, really good.
Yeah, like, he can do comedy. He can do, like, in Tin Cup, in Bull Durham.
He can do comedy.
He's really good in those films, doing, like, witty, verbal comedy. He's not, like... when you see him in interviews, he's not very funny, but he's not a comedian. But giving a script, he knows how to do comedy. And then he can do... these big epic dramas as well.
The guy's also a movie star. So I'm not saying that The Bodyguard is the greatest film ever made. No. But his you may know this. That was supposed to be Princess Diana in the lead role. Mm-hmm. And I believe that Costner actually went to Buckingham Palace, or wherever she lived.
Yeah.
One of the other ones. One of the other palaces. But he actually went. He spent time
bedroom.
With her to try... to convince her to do the role, and so Whitney was not the first choice. But Costner in that movie, so I know that Costner is a huge fan of Steve McQueen, so I remember once watching Costner on Letterman, and he told a story that to be more like Virgil Hilt, McQueen's character from The Great Escape, he tore off the sleeves on his sweaters. Tragically, I used to do the exact same thing, so when Costner said that to Letterman, my tiny mind just exploded. So I have a lot of love for Costner, and not in an ironic way, in a very genuine way. He made a movie early this year called Criminal, which is not a terrific film, but he is very, very good in it. And it's sort of him almost doing a little bit of Taken. It's Costner
kicking ass, playing a bit of a bad guy who might not be all bad. I think it'll be out on DVD by now. Check it out. Ryan Reynolds is in it as well.
And Gary Oldman, Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones is in it for some reason. I've no idea why, because he's not in it very much. He seems like a waste of TLJ.
Can I just say, though, he has, in the last 5 years, this is Costner, done these sort of comeback movies, and they're not right. They're not him.
It's not quite Kevin.
It's not quite Kevin.
It's not
he keeps
quite
trying
Kevin.
To do, like, what would Harrison do? What would Liam do? Like, it's all these different types of... When you look at the films... Oh, by the way, he has twice almost been in a Tarantino film. I know Tarantino wanted him in to play Bill in Kill Bill, and he wanted him in... He was actually even cast in Django Unchained and then had to drop out because... of scheduling problems. Now,
is it the Don Johnson part?
I think it might have been.
Yeah, I
yeah.
think it is. Yeah.
And I think it needs something like that, where someone who gets what he is good at. Listen to us, like we should work.
Kevin, if you listen, yeah. We love you so much.
But look at these films, yes. And this is why I don't think his comeback has happened yet, because these aren't the kind of films that he's trying anymore. And listen to this CV, right? Starting from 1985, he was in Fandango. Have you seen Fandango?
Yes, I have.
Beautiful little film. Silverado, lots of fun. Lawrence Kasdan. The Untouchables, which was the
Mate,
one that just...
it's a classic.
It's a brilliant. No Way Out, an amazing thriller.
And he's very good in it.
Bull Durham, he's amazing.
Oh, my
in.
God. Yes.
Field of Dreams. Schmaltzy,
stop it, Pink
but
Costner.
It's so good. Revenge, not quite as good. Dances with Wolves, which is a classic. I know people are annoyed because it beat Goodfellas at the Oscar, but I don't care. It's an amazing film. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, a guilty pleasure.
Russell Crowe called that film a Bon Jovi video.
Well, it is, yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
The Bodyguard, a guilty pleasure. A Perfect World, a brilliant film. And then it starts getting a little bit patchy, but that run of films of about 10 films that I would say some of them are classics. Then it gets a bit weird. Like, it's like, what are you, Kevin? Do what you're good at.
He's a movie star, isn't he?
Anyway, people are going to either love us or hate us
but
for saying
this. If you're a screenwriter, because people listen to the show.
Okay,
with films.
Well, here you go. Right. So in How Not to Live Your Life, I had Don was obsessed with Kevin Costner because for two reasons. One, I am, but B, I understand the slight sort of naffness of it. So I thought it would be a funny character, funny character trait. And, you know, I love him. In the Christmas special that we knew was going to be the end, we were trying to get him to come and do a cameo. You know, like in High Fidelity where John Cusack sees Bruce Springsteen at the end of his bed?
Yes.
We wanted to do that where Costner gives him some advice. And we managed to speak to Costner's agent and they were saying, look, this wasn't a yes, but they were saying the only way he'll do it is if, because we had to cut together a little reel.
This is already the best story I've ever heard in my life.
We had to cut together a reel of all the times Don has mentioned Kevin Costner, Sir Kevin of Costner, whatever the, in so many weird references. And it was like a 2-minute reel of all these references. We sent it to him and he went, look, we can see that you love him. It would be a really funny thing to do. The only way you can do it is if you fly to, it was some like Eastern European country where he was filming at the time and shoot it there, which we just couldn't afford. No.
He would have done it.
Yeah, well, his agent was saying he would have done it, but anyway,
that's
enough Kevin.
Yes.
Enough Kevin. We love you, Kevin. We can't wait for you to make Dances with Wolves 2, The Revenge.
Revenge of the Wolves.
What
sort of role should he play then? Hang on a minute, I've just remembered probably his best ever film.
Go on.
Open Range, a Western with
Amazing,
Robert De Niro.
Which he directed. Oh, and JFK!
JFK, yeah,
come on.
Of course, yeah. Philip French, the late great Observer film critic, said that Open Range is one of the greatest films of this century.
Wow.
Yeah, but there's a shootout in that movie.
At the end, it's amazing.
It's just wonderful. And when they're playing cards at the start and Duvall calls the kid out for cheating... Oh, it's just...
Yeah, it's,
please, go on to Amazon, buy Open Range.
So that's probably... That's what I would say. And in answer to your question about what should he do next, I think he is about to direct something, so that would be...
I think he should, yeah, because I think with Open Range, he'd learnt his lesson that the 3.5-hour epics weren't for everyone, and Open Range is a leaner, meaner movie.
It's still quite prosaic in parts.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's about...
But never once are you thinking, come on, Kev.
Yeah. So listen, news and reviews. Let's not do the entire show about Kevin as much as I love him. News and reviews. What have you got for us today?
Well, please? So it has come out the past couple of days that the People's Champion, Dwayne Johnson, is officially the highest paid movie star on the planet. And I would say that this is a good thing because Dwayne Johnson, by all accounts, if you speak to anyone who's ever met him, or interviewed him or spent time with him or worked with him, they will all say the same thing. He is the nicest man who ever lived. I recently interviewed the director of Central Intelligence. He also directed Dodgeball. He's making another movie with Dwayne Johnson next year. And I said, is it true that Dwayne Johnson, is he really this nice? And this director said, James, he's the nicest man I have ever met. He's the nicest human being I have ever met. And on that list, I include my own mother. And so I think that Dwayne Johnson being the number one.
So a director
paid,
is saying he's nicer than his mum.
Dwayne Johnson is even nicer than his own mother. So I'm saying it's a victory for the good guys. And I think in this day and age, and we know from comedy, that if you are a bit of a douchebag, people don't want to work with you. So in the past,
Not always.
You know what I mean, though? I think in the past, you could get away with being a vile diva. I think in this day and age,
Someone will video you at some
point. Someone will tweet you if you say, you know. Yeah. And so I think that's for all the ills of social media and technology, etc. I think it's no bad thing that, maybe we all need to be a little bit nicer. Mm. So God bless you, Dwayne Johnson.
That's a lovely message. Do you know how much he gets per movie? Because there was a time in sort of the early 90s, mid-90s, I think, where people were getting 20, 25 million per movie.
The reason why people like that... So people, it was when the likes of Will Smith and Jim Carrey, they could demand these vast sums of money, and it was because how they opened a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So the caliber of the star alone would guarantee a box office smash. Those days are
well and truly gone.
Well and truly over. So one example I would give is that, and we all love Christian Bale, so if Christian Bale is playing Batman, for example, people would be queuing around the cinema and the film would definitely take billions of dollars. But when Christian Bale is appearing in a lower budget Werner Herzog movie, for example, it's a trickier sell at the cinema.
Yeah.
That's not to the detriment of Christian Bale. He's one of our finest actors. It's just a fact. And so the reason why movie stars these days can make these vast sums of money is that they will get tie-ins and back-ends.
Yeah.
And it's why people like Johnson and Robert Downey Jr. are still able to make a fortune, because they very cleverly get percentages rather than necessarily demanding
the money up front. When you emailed me, just quickly, I'm not going to go into depth with this, but when you emailed me this morning, like news you wanted to chat about, there was one that just said The Rock, and I thought you were going to mention this. This was something I saw in The Guardian last week. The headline is The Rock, the movie The Rock, the Sean Connery, Nicolas Cage movie.
Yes.
The Rock movie plot may have inspired MI6 sources' Iraqi weapons claim. What they're saying is there's an allegation in the MI6 report about Iraq's supposed chemical weapons before the 2003 war that appears to have been lifted from the Hollywood film The Rock.
Oh, that's
according to the Geocott report.
If that is true, that is horrifying, because we're movie lovers and people say, oh, the criminal was influenced by the films, and you go, nah, blame the parents, you know. But oh God, please tell me that's not true.
I hope not as well. But we won't be blaming parents. We'll be blaming the government.
Oh, man.
Anyway.
Wonderful movie, The Rock.
Yeah. It's the only Michael... Is that Michael Bay? I think it is, yeah.
Yes.
It's the only one of his that I really, really love.
I'm with you. So I can't... I know a lot of people love Con Air. I want to love that film, and I just can't. But The Rock, I really love. The chemistry. We've talked about it before, but Cage and Connery in that film were awesome. One other thing we were going to talk about was Sulu. It's attracted quite a lot of attention, the fact that in the upcoming Star Trek Beyond, Sulu is gay. And it's been controversial.
Which, this shocked me, this what you're about to tell me.
Well, so I've seen the film. I'm embargoed, so I'm not allowed to say...
Not that he was gay. That's not what I'm shocked by. But what you're about to say is what shocked me.
I don't know what I'm about to say. What shocked
George,
you?
George Takei?
So George Takei has come out and said that he is unhappy that they've done this, whereas Simon Pegg has come out, who obviously has a lot of respect for you know, Pegg, I've been fortunate to speak with Simon Pegg. I know that he's a good dude and he has respect for the history of Star Trek. So I know that they did this coming from a very good place. And it was sort of an homage, a tribute, a doff of the cap to Kai himself. It would appear that things are fine now. I think that Takai appreciates that it came from a good place. I've seen the film and it's done in a really beautiful way. Mm. It's done. We see Sulu greet his partner and it's a hug, it's an embrace, and they walk away and they have their arms around each other. I'm not spoiling anything. This happens about 30 or so minutes into the film, and so not a big deal is made. It's just done as a very throwaway matter of fact. This is how it is. So while I am embargoed, please check out Star Trek Beyond. I think I can say that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that will offend
anyone. Did you actually speak about this issue with Simon Pegg?
No. I'll tell you why, because it had already been out in the news. Okay. Takai had said his bit, Pegg had said his very respectful bit. There was just no need to go there.
So Takai, who obviously has spent a lot of time in his life fighting for gay rights and LGBT rights and what have you, and he was like, oh, well, that's not the character. The character was never that. And I was quite surprised. I would have thought that, you know, obviously I don't come from the same position that he's coming from. we won't make any jokes about that. I just was like, well, surely any kind of reference where you're saying that this is okay, equality's good, is a good thing. But so I was surprised that he had a bit of a problem with it.
I agree completely. And I also think... this has already become one of our serious chats. Yeah. we'll do this every now and then. I also think I feel that we have come a long way as a society. You know, films reflect society because the way it's done is very tasteful. And the point I'd made to Dan earlier today is that when we were growing up in the 80s, I mean, you must remember, dear listener, the way that homosexuals were portrayed in Hollywood was often... Yeah. Frankly, disgraceful. Yeah, yeah. So the Australian comedian Sarah Kendall does a wonderful bit about how homosexuals were portrayed in 80s cinema, and the bit she refers to is the Blue Oyster scene in Police Academy.
God, yeah.
But as a child, I'm sure we thought it was hysterical.
Oh, it was amazing but, as a child.
And when you look back on it now, obviously it doesn't sit well. Because as Sarah says, so the scene in the Blue Oyster bar, the policemen end up in there, and...
Are you doing someone else's routine right now?
Well, no, because this is from a show of hers from a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And I'm crediting her.
Yeah, yeah,
if I was saying this is my opinion, that would
just
be outrageous. But
up,
the fact that I'm crediting one of my favourite comedians. So the point, I mean, okay, I don't want to do her bit because it is a wonderful bit and you must see Sarah live. So I suppose, you know, if we're going to put a positive top on this, in the space of 20, 30 years, you know, thank goodness we are making progress in the way that... homosexuality doesn't define the character of Sulu. What defines Sulu is his bravery, his brilliance at his job, the fact that he's a beloved member of the Enterprise crew. In the past, Hollywood let homosexuality define the characters, which obviously is ludicrous. Yeah.
I always feel like from the 80s, the thing that always shocks me so much is Eddie Murphy. Like his routines about homosexuals are pretty... I mean,
so I mean,
and I obviously adore like anyone that's ever been involved in comedy and grew up in our.
He's Elvis Presley of comedy. Yeah, the guy is a to say he's a god is almost not doing Eddie Murphy justice.
So it always slightly goes. Oh,
but
Eddie,
I put an Eddie Murphy the special you are referring to. I had that on not that long ago, and I was watching it, and my wife was in the room next door, and she actually came in to say. What? She couldn't believe that this was a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously that comedy, that bit in question has aged, horrendously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. What else you got?
So the final bit of news was that Dan Harmon has come out and said that there will be a Community movie. Mm-hmm. So are you a fan of the show Community?
I do like it. I'm not nuts about it, but I do like it, yeah.
The thing with Community, and you know, you and I are big comedy fans. When I saw the first two seasons, my jaw sort of hit the floor. I just thought it was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. Oh my goodness, I've never seen anything like it. It was clever. I know you can't use the word meta out loud without someone punching you in the face, but I love you and I apologise. But I just thought it was so smart, it was so beautifully written. I know that then the show had its own troubles. off camera, and that impacted what was going on camera. So I guess the fact that a community movie will happen is a wonderful thing. I think if you are a comedy fan, and if you're listening to the show, there's probably a strong chance that you are. Do watch Community if you've never seen it. Because it's a show that you hear a lot about, mm-hmm. and then before you watch it, you think, "Well, I'll be the judge of that." And then when I watched it, I thought, "God, this really is special."
Well, you know what? The other day finally got round to watching Silicon Valley, which I just keep hearing wonderful things about, and I just hadn't watched. And I watched it, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I thought, "Oh," and it surprised me that I enjoyed it. Now, I talk a lot about this with other people on, about like when you work in comedy over a certain amount of time, it becomes harder to enjoy other comedy because you know the tricks, you understand the kind of rules and all that sort of stuff. It's like any kind of craft in any profession. Some of the magic goes a little bit, so it becomes harder. But I also do think that there's an element of, and this is something you said you would like to talk about at some point, is like, are there, how many great sitcoms are there at the moment? You know, like genuine, bona fide, classic sitcoms being made that everyone's, and even in film as well, generally, like, it's just a very, very odd time for comedies.
I agree. I still think that in terms of movies, there are still incredible comedies getting made. So a film that I was lucky enough to see quite a while ago, it's out this week, is Keanu.
Okay.
Which is a Warner Brothers comedy, and it stars Key and Peele. And if you are a comedy fan and you love to laugh and you love going to comedy nights and you love watching Key and Peele on the internet, basically I'm just describing my own life. I implore you to go watch this film. It is just...
Well, these two guys that you're talking about, they are genuinely hilarious guys. Now, you know, it's just their TV stuff is sketch shows, so sketch shows always hit and miss. But
I'll tell you who they remind me of, and I say this with love in my heart, they actually remind me a lot of Hale and Pace.
What?
Yes indeed. So I was a big Hale and Pace fan, and some of Hale and Pace's sketches, it's very easy to knock Hale and Pace because it was, you know, it was ITV and some people were critical of them. Some Hale and Pace sketches are really, really funny.
I'm beginning to think that all we do on this show is shout out to people that don't get enough credit than they deserve. Do you know what I mean?
I've said this, yeah, true. I've said this to other friends.
I'm not sure about, do you know, this will blow your mind. I was in a sketch in Hale and Pace. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. When I was like 17 or something ridiculous, I had one line and it was the punchline. So that was great.
I can't believe you've always been my hero. And each week you just go up a few notches.
But I'm not sure, with all due respect, if you rewatch their stuff. You're saying Key and Peele.
Yes.
Are like Hale and Pace.
I'll explain. Because
I think you've taken drugs this morning.
No. I've been saying this for quite a long time. So the reason being is that a lot of their TV sketches have a punchline that is a real, almost like a punch to the face. Yeah. I mean, it's a really aggressive punchline that gets a big laugh. And Hale and Pace would invariably end on a big killer punchline. And their chemistry, I mean, they're more versatile than Hale and Pace. I mean, mm-hmm. Key and Peele's ability to do different characters is like nothing I've ever seen.
Well, that's
before.
The thing. They're like character actors who happen to be brilliant comics. And it's for me, it's their physicality. They've just got funny bones.
And the chemistry they have between each other. There's a scene in Keanu where basically the gag of Keanu is that they both play guys who've probably got a little bit too middle class the older that they've got, and in this movie they have to act incredibly tough to infiltrate some gangsters. And there's one scene where they're trying to act tough and on the spot they have to think of gangster names, and the way in which Peele thinks of a gangster name on the spot, I won't spoil it, and the way Key reacts to it is comedy gold. Really? It's a beautiful scene. So yeah, Keanu is my big recommendation.
Keanu,
this week.
Just for people that are thinking, what is this film? It's where their cat, who is called Keanu,
That's
is kidnapped, right? And they're trying to get the cat back.
It's a great story. Yeah. So in this day and age, you have to put out a teaser trailer in order to drum up interest in a movie. And so they put a teaser trailer out for Keanu a long, long time ago. Keanu Reeves' sister saw the teaser trailer, immediately phoned her brother, told him all about it. He loved it. He phoned Key and Peele directly and said, tell me what I have to do to be in this film. They told him he took a break from filming John Wick 2 to ensure he appears in this movie.
They must have gone and done a reshoot or something for that.
I will say no more. When you see the movie, you'll see how they did it.
I love it.
Beautiful. Keanu Reeves, God bless you, my friend.
Okay, so listen, we're going to have to wrap up now. I thought that what I would do, because of how much we've spoken about him, there is only one person I could play a song by right now. Now,
Hale and Pace.
Hale and Pace, who are one person.
He's listened to the stonk. Yeah.
Oh, God. Still can't believe that. I can't believe that. I don't like bad-mouthing people, but when I last rewatched Hale and Pace, I was like, ooh, definitely of its time.
Watch that. Well, the table tennis sketch is...
We can't go into this. Okay. We're running out of time. Sorry. So there's only one person we can play a song by, and you're going to be surprised that this person even has songs, and that is Kevin Costner. He has a band and he plays songs. Now, admittedly, I've listened to the songs. They're not to my taste. I mean, I could say worse things, but I'm just going to leave it at that. However, he did the score to a TV miniseries that he did called Hatfields and McCoy, and it's really good. It's really good. It's really stripped down. It's folksy. And I'm going to play a song from that because we've spoken about him. Kevin, if you are listening, I'm sorry I don't love your other band, but I love your films. I love what you're about. Here is Kevin Costner and Modern West with Devil's a Long Way Home. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
I was empty-handed when I needed something. I saw life go wasted. It was all or nothing. I was left for dead when I was cut to the bone. I've been a long, long way from home. I've seen true forgiveness, retribution. I've been close to the truth, but far from salvation. I've seen ghosts in the shadows, blood on the stone, and I'm alone. Long way from home, a leaf on the river after a hard wind blows. The trees grow high and seeds are sown. I was blinded by the light in total darkness. I was filled with wonder. I was cold and heartless. I was the last man standing out there all alone. Long, long way from home, a leaf on the river after a hard wind blows. The trees grow high and seeds are sown.